Preschoolers are sent to kindergartens, and young people who left the mountains have returned with confidence and ambition. Among the deep valleys and ridges, we pass through countless tunnels and finally arrive at Samalada Station.
Sean, the character for Mountain is one of the few pictographs, maybe only a dozen modern characters, that begins to kind of look like an actual mountain.
Well, what does it look like? So what do you mean? How does it look?
It actually looks like three mountains, one big mountain in the middle and two little mountains on the side. Everybody knows the ancient character for Shun. The modern character is actually a line on the bottom and three lines going up. We were in Chengdu, and they have a road there called the Shudao. It was built about 2,000 years ago. And there's a poem from Li Bai during the Tang Dynasty. It's Shudao Zhinan, Nan Yu Shang Qing Tian. It means the Shudao. The Shudao is a road. It's a set of roads that were made about 2,000 years ago, and they connected Shanxi with Sichuan and a few other places. But the roads were extremely primitive, and some of those roads still exist today, and you can go see them and you think, geez, how did they ever get down this road?
How would you describe it? It was like stone, or is it just like a...
Sort of like a creek bed.
Oh, okay. So yeah, it's just like a ravine, a dried up ravine.
Well, sometimes the road is barely a road at all. But, you know, in the United States, my ancestors came out to Oregon after the war. You know which war I mean, the Civil War, 150 years ago. And they came out on the Oregon Trail. The Oregon Trail is very similar to the Shudao. It went from Independence, Missouri to Oregon, and there was basically no road. And they had covered wagons, which were big wagons with very big wheels, and they would cross the rivers and go through the forests and across the desert. And the last wagon train to Oregon was in 1918. So when I grew up in the 50s, I knew people who had actually come out on the wagon trains. Later, they built a highway system in the United States. But
Eisenhower.
In America, we have our Shudao also.
Yeah, that's wild. So now we know why you got this like penchant for travel. You're part of like settlers of the USA. It's in your blood.
Maybe to some extent. But when I grew up, we never traveled. It wasn't in my father's blood, but it was in my great-grandfather's blood. And since we're talking about the Shudao, Shu is an ancient name for Sichuan. And Dao means road. You've probably heard of the Dao De Jing, or in American English, we often call it the Tao Te Ching. The Dao means road. The ancient characters from a pictograph of a road and a foot and a head. That is somebody walking on the road.
This poem that you brought up, do you think that our experience along the Daoyang Mountain can actually be associated or relates to or has an impression that reminds you of this poem from, you know, thousands of years ago?
And well, what is it? Of course, back then the road was like extremely difficult. You had to walk it, either that or take a horse, but it was extremely difficult. Now, this road we took on the slow train, it's not really difficult, but it was very difficult to make. 50 years ago, they didn't have the train.
And yeah, there's tunnels made, right? I mean, they were going even through mountains. So, you know, you'd have to go over mountains on a horse or by foot before, yeah?
Yeah,
and not to mention the snow and the cold and the freezing and my fingers, I can't feel my fingers. Yeah, that type of thing.
The train we took that took 4.5 hours, if you were doing it 100 years ago, it would probably take 4 weeks. You know, my ancestors 150 years ago took, I think, 3 months to get here, you know, to Oregon from Missouri. But You know, some of these things are fairly new. I used to know a priest who was a priest in Tibet, and he told me the first time, I knew this priest like 50 years ago, and the first time he went to Tibet, it took him 52 days to get there. Whereas now we have roads everywhere, and roads, although the roads may not be perfect, we have cars, and it usually doesn't take that long to get anywhere. But historically, these roads were very tough.
Which really pinpoints, accentuates this, how important infrastructure is and how it can change people's lives. So this community who now can do, and I still can't believe it's still an arduous journey in my mind, where you're going every day 4.5 hours each way to go into the city to sell, you know, your chickens or your vegetables, and then come back and do it all again the next day.
The place we went to was called Daliangshan. It means big cold mountain. And if you remember, it was cold, especially my room. It had no heat. You know, we got there in about 4.5 hours by slow train. But if we were walking there like 100 years ago, it would have taken a month to get there. Because you saw those mountains. They were pretty rugged mountains.
Yeah.
So this is the way the world was not long ago. The world has changed in my lifetime. You know, I've been dealing with Chinese for about 50 years. When I first went to Taiwan, I knew old women who were born before the fall of the Qing Dynasty. I knew old women who still had bound feet. Those were the people of my grandparents' generation. Then they died, and there was the people of my parents' generation, and then my generation, and then my generation had children. Now most of my friends are in their 20s. Most of my friends are college students, or, you know, PhD students, or recent graduates. And you talk about the greening of China. I was just thinking about it. In fact, most of my friends, they're often involved in, most of my friends are, what they studied in school was some kind of, you know, water management, groundwater management, pollution management, stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, the modern generation in China is like totally different. It's like we've had five generations in my one lifetime.
And I think, you know, we've, I think, talked about this before. Like, I mean, I can see that when I look at my my wife's family, just how much they're going, just looking from her grandfather's like lifestyle, where he lived, I mean, built his own wooden house, and you know, was a coal miner. He worked in the mines and was gone pretty much, you know, 3 months at a time, and then would come home maybe for a couple of weeks and then leave again to work. I mean, it's like, and my wife's grandmother was left to raise three boys in that house. The house is still there in the little Hu village. And I've seen it. It's just amazing. But it's, you know, it's not, no electricity, nothing. To go from that to where now, what is considered a normal means of living in China, it's just extraordinary. It's like a miracle. There's no other example of that in human history, in my opinion.
50 years ago, or 60 years ago in China, you had millions of people who died of starvation. It was called the Jie, or the Great Starvation. It didn't get fixed overnight. It took several decades, and even until the 90s, we had very poor sections of China where people were barely had enough to eat. But in the past 20 years, it's like when I came to Nanjing 22 years ago, there were virtually no skyscrapers. Now in China, we have built over 1 million high-rises in the past 20, 25 years. If you have any history with China, it's shocking how far we've come in the past 25 years.
I know. And in America, where I'm from, we're arguing over how much we should spend on fixing bridges.
Yeah.
Anyway,
in the past few decades, China has done an extremely good job of bringing up the poor people. There are a couple of characters that indicate people who are poor. In ancient China, you had to have, we didn't have coins. They had cowries, which were shells, which were used for money. And there's a word, ping chong. Ping means separated from money. So you have a part on the top that means separation, and a part on the bottom that comes from a cowrie. That means somebody who doesn't have any cowries, somebody who doesn't have any money. And the second character, chong, if you want to represent people who are poor, you want to indicate that they don't have a very good house. And so you have a part on the top called xue, which is actually comes from a pictograph of a simple house. And the simplified character has a part on the bottom, li, which means that those people have to work very hard. In this case, this is a simplified character, the character for chong. And this is one of the few cases where the simplified character is more logical than the traditional character, because the li indicates that poor people have to work very hard.
So what if you really made it, List? I mean, how would you describe your ascension to financial success? I mean, you got money coming out of your pockets. How would I describe you in Chinese?
Okay, first of all, I don't have money coming out of my pockets.
Yeah, I know there's moths coming out of your pockets right now, but when that time comes, you still got a good, you still got a lot left in you, buddy.
I hope so. But speaking of Chinese characters and riches, how do you draw a picture of rich? How do you draw a picture of indicating that you are rich? In ancient times, if you were rich, if you had a lot of food, that meant you were rich. And in ancient times, you stored food in large containers so that, and hopefully the rats and insects wouldn't get to it, and hopefully it wouldn't spoil. But mainly all your riches, which was mainly food and alcohol, was stored in large jars, vats, or containers. And you had a house too. So the pictograph Fu, if you look at the ancient character, you will find a large container, a jar or a vat indicating it contains alcohol or food. And then you have a building on the top indicating that it's in a house and you live in a house. So that indicated riches. Well, that's the character for riches. Now, how do you get rich? There's a number of different ways that, you know, if you live in a poor village, I have this to say. In South America, you had the drug lords, and they sold lots of drugs to the Americans, and they got very, very rich. But it doesn't matter how rich you are. If you are in a very poor village and you can't buy a hamburger, you're not rich. And so those people who got very rich, they had to build roads so that they could get places. They had to build grocery stores so that they could get good stuff to eat. So there's kind of a logic to trickle-down economics. It's not a very good logic, but that's one of the things that has to happen. It's kind of interesting in South America when you have, you know, some very, very poor villagers and some people who are extremely rich, but your lifestyle is still miserable if everybody around you is extremely poor.
So, I mean, let me rephrase that a little bit, because we have this character for rich. Can this be used kind of poetically or metaphorically? Because you can be rich in knowledge, you can be rich in love. I mean, or is it only like it's about the money, you know, or in this case, like you said, food and booze. If you got the food and booze, you're a rich man.
It's similar to English. You can describe different kinds of fu, you know, as long, if a person is happy, Yes, it's similar to the English. It can be abstracted into, you know, happiness, kind of. But the language is complicated, and you can't just translate something directly from English into Chinese. So, yes, the answer to your question is yes and no.
Okay.
Let me say something about my philosophy and about some people's philosophy. I have some friends that no matter how much money they have, they will never, ever, ever be happy. They're constantly worried about how much money they have and how much money and if they'll have it. But as for me, if I have enough money to pay the rent for the next few months and I have some books or I have the internet, I'm happy and I don't worry. I worry very little about the future. In fact, we have a special situation. I don't own a house, and I probably never will. And also, I don't know how long I'll live. If I have my books and I have enough money to pay the rent for the next year or two, I'm happy. Some people are not happy, no matter how much money they have. Those people are, in my opinion, quite miserable.
So again, so going from this, we've seen this extraordinary expanse in wealth. What is the next step, you think, for China? What is important in their continuing development of the country in order to get to this point of richness?
When you say rich, you know, and you say people are rich now, you know, when I talk about ancient China, you were rich if you had a bunch of containers of food. Most of my life, my house has been full of books, and I have considered myself rich in that respect, but those books cost a lot of money. But now we have the internet. We don't really need books. And all Chinese, even though it's hard to say that Chinese are rich, but they all have the internet. So they have all the books that I would have spent, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or many, many dollars for over decades. The richness is different. Now we have different stuff. Now we have the internet. So on the internet, no matter who you are, no matter where you are, you can do stuff that was impossible to do 20 years ago. China has some problems. 50 years ago, it was starvation. But now young people, they are forced or compelled to spend all of their time studying for the Gaokao, which is the college entrance exam. And young people, it's very difficult for them to get any interests of their own, hobbies and interests, which is necessary if you want to be a happy person. Only now, it's becoming more and more possible to kind of ignore the Gaokao, not exactly, but this is one of the things China will have to do to move into the future. But another thing is, America became a world power through military force. China should not do that. Hopefully they will have things to teach other cultures and become more of a culture-based world power than a military-based world power. That's to be seen in the future.
Yeah. I see China not necessarily wanting to imperialize or, you know, anything, or, you know, especially through brute force. But I do think it's interesting that you bring up the culture, because I think you were right. In America, like, the military factors really spearheaded them from the beginning of the 20th century into mid-20th century. But then after that, it really became a cultural thing, like things about the USA that people, you know, everything from Coca-Cola to Hollywood, like those things really spread. It became the new missionaries, right? Instead of like spreading religion, it became spreading, like, you know, Sylvester Stallone or whatever, you know, movies and McDonald's, that type of thing. So that, I agree, there's got to be, and, you know, you see China investing so much in their own entertainment industry. And I always think it's interesting. Just in the short time that I've lived here since 2013, the quality of the movies, I know you're a book man, but I like the quality of Chinese movies, how they have improved just over the last 10 years. It's amazing. And how other industries see China as such a important demographic. So like, even without China's help, like without Chinese doing, you can see, you know, there is so much more integration of Chinese culture and Chinese references into Western movies, and even consideration on how these movies are going to be made based on like Chinese values, which I think is like this, it's an amazing testament to, you know, almost like a implicit respect for the power that is China. But you're right. I think the next step would be to do that for themselves, and you know, and not, because you don't see, like, there's not a lot of Chinese movies going overseas to, you know, the USA, but you see US movies that have maybe Chinese interests in mind, whether if it's just to, you know, invade the market to make money, but have Chinese interest in mind going, you know, so it's kind of a one-way street right now. I think that would be the next step, in my opinion.
Well, my suggestion to anybody not in China is to come to China and see China for yourself. I can talk about China forever, but it's not the same as being here. So if you're interested, come to China and see what it's like.
Well, Uncle Hanza, thank you so much for teaching me those characters and for sharing the stories behind them and behind, you know, your life and your experiences. Before we end, though, this episode, Uncle Hanza, please make a little preview on our next destination. What are we planning to do?
You'll have to come and see. For the next destination, our next destination is Manchuria, Changchun, which means long spring, and that's we're going to talk about the Winter Olympics and other winter sports. So be with us.
And we'll also compete in our own battle royale of who is the athlete of winter.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. You guys know, I mean, if we're going to place bets right now, who do you think is going to win? A 72-year-old, like, researcher of Chinese characters, or a young, strapping, handsome, fit man? Yes. In his prime, only, yeah. I'm sure you can predict what's going to happen. So, but still, tune in and see.
Well, thank you for listening to My Stories of Chinese Characters podcast series. There are more stories to come, and you can tune to our podcast at radiocgtn.com or any other major podcast platforms to have a listen. For the related videos, you can find them at Learn Chinese on YouTube channel and Facebook page. We'll see you next time.